You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I suspect a lot of people imagine pirates wear eyeliner like Johnny Depp, but you get a very different story if you speak to merchant sailors. Attacks on cargo ships have steadily increased in recent years, and no seas are more feared than the waters around the coast of Somalia. All of this remained abstract to many of us until a day last spring when a cargo ship called the Maersk Alabama was boarded by Somali pirates. Captain Richard Phillips ended up a captive on the ship's lifeboat, unaware of the media frenzy that was growing around him. He tells his story in a new book from Hyperion called A Captain's Duty, Somali Pirates, Navy SEALs, and Dangerous Days at Sea. I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show today. Hello.
Well, thank you very much. Good to be here.
And wasn't the ship first boarded a year ago today?
Actually, it was a year ago today, yes, early in the morning, just after sunrise. A small boat came and followed us, put up a ladder, and boarded our ship.
Does it feel like it's been a year?
Oh, it seems like two or three.
When was the last time you spent this much time on land? You haven't gone out to sea again, have you?
Actually, it's been over since I went to Massachusetts Maritime Academy, starting in 1975. It's been since then that I've stayed in one place for this long. So over 35 years since I've been one place for this long.
So what was your typical schedule in the past? How much time on land, how much time out to sea in a typical year?
Well, my schedule is pretty much 3 months on, 3 months off. So 3 months on the ship, 3 months at home. And I've sailed in the beginning of my career for over 6 months straight. And everyone has different schedules, but we all are pretty much split 50% home, 50% on the ships working.
Are there pirates all over the world?
Well, yeah, I'm glad you asked that. That is very true, what people are surprised to find. We've been dealing with pirates. Indeed, we in the Merchant Marine call it the second oldest profession. We deal with pirates in China, Sulu Sea, Philippines, Malacca Straits, Indonesia, Sri Lanka, Nigeria, and Somalia.
So what makes Somalia special?
Well, Somalia has a different business protocol, and their business plan is basically it's a bully situation working in a high target area on the Goa, the Gulf of Aden area, which is the on and off ramp to the Suez Canal Highway, and it's a target-rich environment, and they know most of the ships aren't armed or aren't protected, so they're just going out. I liken them to hyenas going after the weakest and the softest targets.
How long have they been a problem for merchant ships?
In the Somali area, I'm going to say from late 2005 on, they've been a problem. They've been going farther and farther out, and indeed, they're 1,000 miles out now. They're all the way to Madagascar, to the Seychelles, and just in the last 24 hours, a South Korean ship was taken almost 1,000 miles out.
So, in 2005, you didn't worry about going to this area?
Oh, well, security is always a concern with us since 2001. We didn't want to have another 9/11 problem, you know, with planes, with ships, which is a thing that we are worried about. So, we have always been concerned for security, but even more so since 9/11. So, at that time, we were still going 25 miles off the Somalia coast.
Well, when did you become aware that there was a growing problem?
Well, I've pretty much always been aware as a captain, so I've always tried to stress to my crew that we always have to be ready. We always have to be in a heightened state of alert, no matter where we are. We have to be prepared. You can hope for the best, but you have to plan for the worst.
But it's been my sense that the Somali pirates have become more skilled at what they do over the years, and I'm assuming they've also been emboldened by the success they've had in getting paid.
Oh, sure. Basically, it's warlords that are running these pirates, and these pirates are being more and more successful this year. This past year alone, they've had close to $200 million worth of ransom paid to them in a country that has an average annual salary of less than $200 a year. That is something to be shot after. So for every dollar ransom you pay, you get 10 more people stepping up trying to become a pirate.
Is it possible to steer clear of the area?
I don't think you can steer clear of the area now. There's millions and millions and millions of square miles. We have coalition forces with ships out there, and they're still taking vessels within sight of these military ships. These pirates are not stupid. They're not lazy. They're not dumb. They're evolving, and they're getting better and better at what they do.
So we have the United States and other countries with large merchant fleets patrolling the area, and you say, and they can't stop these ships?
Correct, because it's a crime of opportunity, a bully situation. They're coming up, and as in my situation, from the time of detection to the time of two of them boarding my ship, I'm going to say it was anywhere in the area of 30 to 35 minutes. So it's very quick. They come in fast. fast boats. They have motherships somewhere nearby or just over the horizon, and that's what gets them so far out to sea. And they're very quick, and as I said, they are evolving and getting better at what they do.
And there's no way to spot those motherships?
Yes, detection of, with any security is key to any positive solution, so you have to detect them, and of course then you communicate. We have various forms of communication, telephone, alarms, and so forth, and so then you do that. But we in the Merchant Marine, we don't have the cavalry coming over the hill. We're completely dependent on ourselves. In our business, a laceration can be a death sentence, a storm can be a catastrophe, and a fire can be a disaster. So with pirates, you're pretty much left to your own resources and then hoping that help does eventually come.
Well, can't you also enter this area armed yourself?
Well, yeah, some ships do have weapons, some ships don't. It's a company policy. We do not have weapons. I was basically shooting flares at the pirates in my incident while they were shooting AK-47s at me, so it wasn't a fair firefight, if you will. But now, I don't know if you heard, in November, the Maersk Alabama was attacked again by pirates, and with the assets aboard, turned it into a non-incident. And I think a lot of companies are taking positive steps to protect the seafarers, and that's one concern I have.
What are people shipping in this area? You say in your book that there would be no Walmart without the Merchant Marine. Is Walmart one of the... are you carrying stuff for Walmart when you go in this area?
Well, actually, what I'm talking about that is international trade is based on free commerce and trade, and we are the cheapest forms of transportation is waterborne transportation. So without the International Merchant Marine, there would be no Costco, no cheap goods for the United States, and we are a foundation that's based on. But no, we were carrying mainly, in this area of the world, we were carrying what we call handshake cargo, food for the interior Africa. These are the access points for all of interior Africa in Mombasa, so we're carrying food to Congo, Rwanda, Uganda, as well as Somalia, Catholic Relief Organizations, UN, World Food Program, and the U.S. Food Program.
In other words, stuff that really will help people, the kind of thing that a pirate would find hard to justify holding for ransom.
Oh, and the pirates don't really care about holding the goods. It's just ransom for the people in the ship once they get their money to let it go. But it's also more than that. It's also a power struggle. The warlords do not want other countries or governments or NGOs to come in and feed their people. Because if you feed the people in this area of the world, you have made an agreement. You have won over friends. So if the warlords can steal that food that is trying to get to Somalia, they've now got an army because they're feeding whole cities and towns, and now it's not everyone else, it's the warlords that are doing it. So it's a power struggle. It's not just what they're complaining about due to the fishing rights and chemicals being dumped in their water.
My guest is Richard Phillips, who, with the help of Stephen Talty, has written A Captain's Duty, Somali Pirates, Navy SEALs, and Dangerous Days at Sea, a book that talks about his experiences being boarded by Somali pirates. I would assume that what your ship isn't all that different than a military ship in terms of how it's run.
Well, actually, we are based on a quasi-military system. We do have a chain of command, if you will, and we do are based sort of on a military system, but we don't look anything like a military ship. It's interesting to ask that because in the past, 12 military ships have been attacked by pirates. One just 5 days ago, a Norfolk based destroyer that was attacked at night, which is a change. That's what I call a stealth attack, attacking under cover of darkness, which they've only done a few times. And this is another evolution of the pirates. But
you think they know that these are military ships?
No, that's going back to my point of they're just hyenas attacking anything. They're seeing anything. I don't know if you heard about the unfortunate British couple who are coming mm-hmm. from Seychelles, a yachting destination spot for many people in the world. They were going to Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, and they were taken by pirates 900 miles out because they attack anything. There's nothing that they won't attack. It's just to attack, get ransom, and get some money.
Have you always sailed for the Merchant Marine?
I've been sailing for over 30 years. I came out of Massachusetts Maritime Academy in 1979, and so I've been sailing for then. I've been sailing over 19 years as captain. And so pretty much without stop, I've been sailing since 1979.
And you've had some close calls that had nothing to do with pirates over the years.
Oh, yeah. I've had dealings with icebergs. I've had stoved-in hulls. I've had damaged hulls. I've had medical emergencies, heart attacks, lacerations, knee amputations. I've had fires in the engine room. I've had fires on deck. And I've had some small dealings with pirates.
You also talk about bad weather while carrying a cargo of explosives. That would be a little scary.
Yeah, I was on a ship there dealing with storms. As I said, a storm can be a catastrophe. We have no one out there. We don't have a police department. We don't have a fire department. We don't have a hospital one block away from us. We are all those things. We're self-contained little microcosm of the population on ships.
So tell me about this voyage. A little over a year ago, you flew into Oman to board the Maersk Alabama. Had you ever captained the ship before?
I'd been on the ship before, yes. I was on a ship. I got off about 5 months before. I'd done about 5 months on the ship for the first time. It had replaced another ship that I was captain of in the same area doing the same run. And I was on the ship approximately five months on the ship, and I was coming back for my second rotation on the vessel.
And the Maersk is, where is that company?
Maersk is a, it's Maersk Line Limited. It's a U.S. company. That's a subsidiary of Maersk Lines, which is the largest shipping company in the world. Out of Denmark.
And how many crew members did you have?
I had 19 crew with myself, so 20 total on the ship.
Is knowing that you're going to go into an area where there are pirates, can you take any precautions?
Oh, yeah, we had taken precautions and, in fact, had a drill 5 days before on the 2nd. We went through a security drill, and on the 7th, the day before, we were going through our fire drills and boat drills and medical evacuation drills. So we're constantly going through drills, constantly training, and that's one thing we get to see in emergency situations and extremis. We get to see how we do in emergency situations, and when you're in that situation, if you can come out and do good and have a good outcome, that really reflects back on you and helps you in the next situation you're in. It's never a boring day out on the ocean.
When did you realize that pirates were targeting your ship?
I don't think they're targeting the ship. Again, the pirates are just going after anything they see. Anything that's floating, anything they see, they're attacking.
So suddenly somebody looked out and saw these little boats coming at you very quickly.
In my incident, there was one boat, which isn't the normal profile for a pirate attack. Normally, it's a mothership with three or four small boats following. But in my incident, it was one small boat. With four pirates aboard. On this boat, they didn't have RPGs, rocket-propelled grenades. They just had two AK-47s and a pistol. So they would fire it and try and make the ship pull over, which, of course, we didn't. We would run fire hoses, sound alarms, charge our hoses. We had fixed hoses to squirt over the side to hamper them. And then we mustered our crew and then put them out of harm's way, was the industry standard, to get them out of harm's way and put them in a makeshift safe room that we had made on the ship.
Even though you have 19 men and there were only four guys who were attacking you?
Well, four guys with automatic weapons.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
And you, as you said, you didn't have any weapons. That was
no.
The policy of Maersk.
That was the company's
Why
policy.
Why would Maersk have that policy?
That was their policy. I don't set policy. I just work on the ship. I'm the captain of the ship, so that's their policy. A lot of ships don't have weapons, but I have been on ships that have. Of course, as I've talked to many times in different places, my belief is that we should have weapons. My belief is that we should have a security team, and we need to harden and train harden the ships, train the crew more, and be given lethal and non-lethal means to protect ourselves at each stage of or level of threat with the pirates.
And I've been reading recently about ships actually being able to stave off pirates because they have been protecting themselves.
Yes, they have had ships using the industry standard, evasive maneuvers, fire hoses, increasing speeds, but it's also similar to an incident we had the day before my incident. We were being followed by three pirate ships and a mothership, and we were able to get away mainly because of the oceans. They were a little rougher. The wind had picked up, and so they weren't able to get to us. So it's just by chance that they can't get there, depending on their training and their ability. But all they'll do then is turn around and try and grab the next ship.
A listener asks, have Blackwater types of companies gotten into this cargo protection business?
Yes, there are many marine security, and they're growing in abundance now with the obvious need for this, and they're proving themselves successful. There were assets in November this past year on the Maersk Alabama when it was tacked again, and they turned it into a non-incident. There's also a Panamanian ship, Dubai-owned, United Arab Emirates, and it protected the ship. Many passenger ships, which have high-value cargo, have always carried weapons and armed teams to protect their cargo, the passengers.
My guest is Richard Phillips, who tells the story of Somali pirates, Navy SEALs, and Dangerous Days at Sea in a book called A Captain's Duty, which is written with Richard Talty.
Stephen Talty.
Stephen Talty. Yeah. I'm sorry, you're Richard. And it is published by
Hyperion.
So we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with Richard Phillips, who's written a book with the help of Stephen Talty called A Captain's Duty. It's published by Hyperion. So these four pirates come upon your ship very quickly. They're usually very young these days, aren't they?
Well, I think that is sort of a misnomer. They are young looking, and they may be young of age. I would say from 20 to mid-20s is their age.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't show me their birth certificate, so I don't know for sure.
Did you think they were sophisticated and knew what they were doing?
I don't think these pirates were that sophisticated. They did make a few mistakes that allowed me to communicate with my crew to keep them somewhat safe, to pass on information. But they were very hazardous to myself and the two crew members who were kept ransom or kept hostage on the bridge during this 12 to 13-hour cat-and-mouse game on the ship.
Were you able to radio for help?
Yes. Before they got to by the time we first detected them, we had already called UKMTO, United Kingdom Maritime Transport Organization, already let them know our situation. Of course, they get a lot of calls, and they were just relaying how many captains are nervous, and it may be just a fishing boat, but we pretty much knew the situation we were in. And then we called again at a mile to confirm that, yes, indeed, we are in a piracy situation.
And how long did it take for them to find you? Did they know you were the captain from the start?
The pirates actually two boarded down on the main deck and were firing up at me with AK-47s while I'm doing a jack-in-the-box routine, firing flares down at them and down at the boat to keep the third pirate from boarding. And one of them got away from me, and I lost his location. I thought he was still in the main deck, but he was actually shooting through barricades we had and was up on the bridge very, very quickly. He came to the bridge, fired two shots, entered the bridge, and said, "Relax, relax, Captain, just business, relax, no Al-Qaeda."
And then he said, "Turn off the engines." Why that?
Well, he wanted me to slow down, because that's the whole thing. You have to slow down so they can get aboard, because it's very hard to get aboard a ship that's moving. So he wanted me to slow down the engines, quit operating the wheel, which by now I was able to pass on via my handheld radio I had by my side, that bridge is compromised, two pirates on the bridge.
Mm-hmm. It gets hot when the engines are cut off, doesn't it?
Well, with the engines cut off and the power cut off eventually, there is no AC on the ship. It is pretty much a glass enclosure in the on the bridge.
And you're in
a pretty hot area.
Hull,
yep. Starts heating up very quickly.
Did they ask for a specific amount of money?
At first, they weren't considered with money. They first wanted to know what the nationality was, and they actually were high-fiving each other when they found out we were a U.S. ship. They thought they were in for a big payday from a rich American steamship company, but in a little while, they soon realized they had a lot of problems. They couldn't find the crew. Nothing on the ship seemed to work. The crew wouldn't come out of hiding. They wouldn't listen to the captain who was telling them to come out of hiding, and they couldn't get in touch with their mothership nor with their people in Somalia. They actually had me try to call cell phones in Somalia to let the people know.
Well, also, I would assume that you can get a higher ransom if the ship is carrying something of great value. If you are carrying diamonds or something, or oil, for that matter.
They really don't care. It's just the people's lives in the ship for hostage, and they're just waiting to get remuneration and a ransom.
Were you planning all along to offer yourself as a hostage in exchange for the release of the crew?
No. At that point, on the ship for that 12 or 13 hours, that cat and mouse time, I was just trying to slow things down, to control things, to try and think what would be best for the outcome. I was already taken hostage on the bridge with two of my crew, my third mate, Colin Wright, and my able-bodied seaman, ATM. So I basically let them go through. They saw the boat, and they had all these problems with my crew, with my ship, and they eventually wanted to get off. They had lost their ship when they boarded their boat. So I just said, "I'll help you get off. I'll help you get off the ship." And for me, it was actually a defining moment, because three of my four problems were solved. My crew, my ship, my cargo would be safe and free, and then I just had to worry about myself, and I was pretty sure that I could get away from them once I got in the boat.
There was a point where you were preparing to leave the main ship along with the pirates. Didn't you start giving them orders?
Yes, that was sort of, it was actually a strange, surreal moment because I once they agreed and I had gotten them fuel and a little food and some water for the man overboard boat, our rescue boat, a rigid inflatable 20-foot boat, we were all down there. We were getting ready to lower the boat. But, of course, with all the power shut off, the hydraulics, the electric, and everything else, now my crew, I was able to talk to my second-in-command, Shane Murphy, another Massachusetts Maritime grad, and my chief engineer, Mike.
With a walkie-talkie.
With my walkie-talkie, which I had, even in the lifeboat, I had by my side. And they, all of a sudden, appeared up on the bridge, approximately three floors above us on an apartment building. And so they were watching us, and I just said, keep an eye on them. I can't tell, you know, if they're going to come chasing after you. That was my fear, that they'd come out once my crew started coming out. And when it was time to get the ship going, the crew did a great job, and they were instrumental in the positive outcome of this incident. And they came out of hiding and then got to work getting the ship ready to get underway.
In the book, you mention a series of mistakes that you made. Given the circumstances, it's a very short list.
Well, I am a big, my crew knows I am a big critiquer. After I have a drill, I always critique it, and I like to get other people's ideas in there. Everyone has something to say and has an idea. So as I went through it after the incident, you know, I would think about certain things that, if I do that next time. And I have other things I don't
write
in the book.
What did you do wrong?
For one, something that bothered me in the lifeboat for the next 3 days was, you know, I should have dropped that boat. We were 40 foot above the air. We were suspended on a davit or a falls, and I should have just done the emergency release and just tried to drop them, which would have probably killed them or seriously injured them at the time. And that's when I was in a lifeboat. I kept thinking back to that. I should have done that. And the other thing is, I don't think we should have traded hostages. Once we're in the boat, that should have been it. We're done. We're over. Do what you want.
My guest is Richard Phillips, Captain Richard Phillips. His book, A Captain's Duty, written with Stephen Talty and published by Hyperion. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Did you have a strategy at that point for how you might escape?
Well, no. A captain's duty is to take care of his crew, his ship, and his cargo, so I didn't, and that's what was bothering me. I was just trying to slow everything down. Things were moving too fast at times. I was acting like a sort of a dummy. You know, they'd say something, and I'd say, what? What? And at one point, even one of my crew would, yeah, he's saying, and I said, I know what he's saying. I'm just trying to slow things down so I can try and regain control. But it wasn't until walking around, they saw the boat, and I saw they were thinking about getting off, that I wanted them to make that decision, so it wasn't something pushed on them. And once my crew did a great job of taking hostage their leader, that really played into the hands and then allowed us to start that plan to get them into the boat and off my ship.
Didn't the Navy SEALs try to send you messages while you were on the lifeboat?
Actually, they did, and that's another pleasure of writing this book, is I get to highlight the true heroes of the story, the Navy SEALs. But they actually did have a password that that they tried to pass to me, but I didn't know they knew our password. They tried to give me a yellow shirt, I guess for identification, but I didn't want to put it on because I was so filthy, and actually the pirates physically made me put it on. And then they gave me words from my wife that I knew were from my wife by what was said, and that I did get.
So that by this time you realize that the Navy SEALs are on the case.
Well, I didn't know they were Navy SEALs. I just thought they were regular Navy, the military. I didn't know they were extraordinary, you know, what I call the titans, the heroes of the story. They do an unbelievable job. I didn't know that, so I didn't really know exactly what's going on. At one point, they did ask me, where do I sit? And I said, right here, here's where I sit. For some reason, I thought it was important for me to stay in one position during the whole ordeal, so I did try and do that. And then they asked me, where do you relieve yourself? And basically, I laughed, and I said, right here. But unbeknownst to me, they were trying to get me to come out to the stern of the boat, which the pirates wouldn't let me anyway, and then jump in, and they had weapons ready to fire in that course, but the pirates wouldn't let me.
But then you did try to escape.
Well, I always was going to try and escape. I talked to Shane Murphy, now in charge of the ship, my second in command, and I told him via my handheld radio, once we're in the boat, we were both actually the Maersk Alabama and the lifeboat drifting next to each other, and he was actually talking to the pirates about, come on back on, and tomorrow we'll redo it, and we'll straighten this thing out, you know. He was just communicating with them, and I had a chance to tell him, if you see a splash coming out the back door, that's me. Come and get me.
Was there a point on the lifeboat when you thought you might actually be killed?
Well, it is another point of the book that I'd like people to come out of it. Yes, when I was in the quiet recesses of my mind and thinking to myself, I said, Rich, well, I'm in a tough spot. No one knows I'm out here. I got armed Somali pirates that don't give a damn about my life. And I found a strength in me that allowed me to do things I didn't think I was capable of. And I think we all have that inner strength that that we don't know, that potential to get through the problems we have in our personal and professional life. And we are stronger than we even know.
How long were you out on the boat before you were rescued?
I was on the boat for 4-plus days on the lifeboat itself, and it was a very tiring time. It was very hot. I don't think people realize how hot it is. The temperature was probably 90 to 95 degrees, which isn't too bad for that area of the world. But the humidity and being inside an enclosed lifeboat and the sun beating down. We on ships have the pleasure of bookending our days with sunrises and sunset, and I look forward to both those events of the day, sometimes to start it, sometimes to end it. But in the lifeboat, I dreaded. It was really a dreadful time for me as the sky started to lighten up, and I knew I was in for another 12 to 15 hours of sitting in a sauna.
Do sailors who are traveling near Somalia get paid more because they're putting themselves at risk?
No, there is no extra pay for the locations. Much of the history of the Merchant Marine, another reason why I wanted to write a book is to enlighten people of what we do in our history. FDR said during World War II, the Merchant Marine carried the lifeblood of the World War II forces and paid for it with their own lifeblood. Actually, the ratio of deaths to a group, you were more likely to die in the Merchant Marine than in any other service branch during World War II. And there are some true heroes that sailed during that time. It was a tough period. So, no, we don't really get war pay. We don't get extra bonuses for dangerous areas. And our industry is inherently dangerous. But it's an individualistic, rugged, can-do people that sail out there. Men and women sail out on these ships.
Somalia is a failed state. It's often called the world's most dangerous country. And Forbes magazine says it's more dangerous than even Afghanistan and Iraq. Do you think that the Somalis, at least some of them, turned to piracy out of desperation?
Well,
some of them are even claiming that that Western countries have used the seas near Somalia as a waste dumping ground, and that's a justification for their hijacking.
Well, that's another misnomer I like to dispel. What they say is exactly what you say: we're dumping hazardous waste, oil, things like that off their waters, and also international fishing fleets are coming in and taking their fish. But if we just take the United States, for example, ships dump oil in our waters. We don't turn into pirates. We stop our fishermen from fishing in Gloucester and New England because of the fish levels are low, but they don't turn to pirates. It's sort of a false accusation, and actually that is one area of the world that I've always said I wonder why there isn't more fishing men here, because you can look at the water and you'll see things move: whales, fish, birds. There's a lot of wildlife and fish in this area that could be fish. So it's really a misnomer to make an excuse for this very life-threatening piracy actions.
Another story you tell in this book is about the media frenzy that affected your family.
Yeah, I did. I think people don't realize how intrusive they are, and I say somewhat kiddling but half truthful. I think my wife had it worse than I. I had four pirates. She had to deal with the media, and I think in trying times, much like we have now with this mine situation in West Virginia, the families are going through very hard times. And not only do they have to put up with their sorrow, the deaths in their family, the trouble with their loved ones and fellow workers, they have to put up with the media, and it's very intrusive. And if you ever have been through that, it's truly, I feel, it's denigrating, and it's just no fun to go through.
Although there are plans to turn the story into a film, that's just going to even be more of an invasion of privacy.
Yeah, but right now my story is a dead story, really. It's happened a year ago, and after that there will be an uptick in maybe interest, but I think it is a good story. It's a great story. It's an inspiring story about the Merchant Marine and about modern-day pirates.
Now, when the Navy SEALs started shooting, did you fear that you might get hit as well?
Well, I feared I might get hit. There were problems going on in the boat at the time when the shooting started. I thought I was caught in a crossfire between the pirates, actually. So I'm sitting in the boat with my head as low to the deck as I could go. I was burrowing into that. I'm sure there'll be finger scratch marks on the deck where I was. and it seemed like it went on for 5 or 10 or 15 seconds. I'm sure it was over in 2 or 3. And then when I finally, in the silence, and it's unbelievable the silence you hear after the shots are fired, I picked up, and right behind me is one of the pirates taking his last gasp. I knew he didn't have long to live. And then shortly after, I heard a voice, "Are you okay?" And it was from outside. And then what I learned later was a SEAL came down through the forward hatch, and then we exited out the after hatch.
Not long after you returned, another media circus happened when the only surviving pirate, Abdi Gader Musa, arrived in New York to stand trial.
Yeah, he was their leader through the whole operation. He was a good leader. At one time, I called him a friggin' Napoleon. But he was a good leader, and I commented on that. He had control of his men, and they followed him. But he's on trial now. I really believe he gave up. I mean, he quit. He left his buddies to die. He somehow was smart enough to see the end coming, and he bailed. But he's in court now. He will be going to court. I will be testifying in that. He's in the judicial realm now, and that's their decision to do with them as they may.
Now, this story got a lot of attention, partly, I'm sure, because it was an American ship, partly because of the way the situation was resolved. But as you pointed out earlier, there are a lot of hijackings. The South Korean ship you were talking about that was hijacked just this week, there was also a case where a Taiwanese crew was held for ransom for 7 months.
Yeah.
And yet these just get little blurbs in the newspaper, if anything. Is it because they're usually resolved through a ransom?
Well, that is one of the pleasures I have in my book, to talk about this. Everyone thinks, oh, it's just a ransom. It'll just, the normal time is 3 to 4 months being held ransom with very little water, very little food, locked in a room at gunpoint as they go through ritual and threatening motions. So it is a horrific time.
It could give really a man PTSD.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if there's any sex going on, but
no,
I understand.
Post-traumatic stress disorder.
But it is a very threatening and horrific experience. But I get to highlight that this is still going on. Things are still going on out there. People, right now we have over 15 ships, almost 200 people under gunpoint, under ransom, some for as long as 7 months. And just for an example, the unfortunate British couple who were taken on a yacht just south of the Seychelles, which is about almost 1,000 miles off of Somalia. They were headed to Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, and they've been held since early November in Somalia. And these are just sailors. These are civilians. They aren't merchant mariners. But as I said, these are just hyenas attacking anything they see.
So their range is now extending 1,000 miles?
Oh, yes. The South Korean ship we just talked about was just under 1,000 miles out. They've attacked ships north of Madagascar. There's millions and millions and millions of square miles where they're reaching to. And indeed, motherships are being taken from Pakistan, fishing boats, and people thrown over the side, never to seen again. One occasion, they did find some of the fishermen swimming in the middle of the Indian Ocean, never to show up again. Now, it just so happens in that just yesterday, they took a mothership that was involved in attacking a ship, and that ship was taken in January. So they're actually going after smaller boats to turn into 100-foot, 80-foot dhows, what have you, to turn into the motherships, which will pull their smaller boats thousands of miles out to sea and then attack the ships from that platform. So, you know, it's more than just ships. It's more than we hear about. Unfortunately, we in the United States don't hear all that's going on. But every day, ships are being attacked and taken inside of military coalition forces in the Gulf of Aden region.
Don't you plan to go to sea again in June?
I am due to go back to work sometime after June 1st to the company I work for, and if they'll have me, I intend to be back on one of their ships.
Would you ever go anywhere within 1,000 miles of Somalia again?
Oh, if I had the proper assets, I'd have no problem with trading in those areas.
Captain Richard Phillips has written, with the help of Stephen Talty, A Captain's Duty, Somali Pirates, Navy SEALs, and Dangerous Days at Sea. It's published by Hyperion. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.